Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. This episode is the first in a two-part look at the insects. Now, we all know that they're the most diverse group of animals in the world today, and yet, despite that, if we went onto social media, how many pictures of bones would we see before we even saw a fossil insect? And then there's simple questions like, how rich is their fossil record? When did they evolve? What were the first insects like? That I just don't know the answer to. So, I've turned to Dr. David Penny, Honorary Lecturer at the University of Manchester and owner of Ceres Scientific Press. He's just published a book on this very subject, An Overview of Fossil Insects, An Introduction to Paleoentomology, and it seemed like the obvious place to start. And then what's more is that we've got a copy of this book to give away. So for your chance to win it, you've simply got to like our competition post on the PaleoCast Facebook page. That's it. Like the page, like the post. Easy. Not sort of. We're only going to count the likes on our original post. If that gets shared on other timelines or in other groups, we're not going to count those likes, just the ones on our page. The deadline is midnight, coordinated universal time, on the 14th of March, where we'll pick a winner at random and make an announcement in the second part of this interview released on the 15th. Now, I've known Dave for about 10 years now. It was a lecturer of his during my undergraduate degree at the University of Manchester that got me into paleontology in the first place, and then a project with him on spiders in amber in my final year that got me into studying chelicerates, and here I am today doing my PhD on them, so I've got a lot to thank him for. We start this interview a little differently, getting to know Dave and Ceres Scientific Press a little before getting into fossil insects. I really hope you're not squeamish. Sorry. But don't forget to listen to the second part of this interview in 2 weeks. But until then, I hope you enjoy this episode. So thank you very much for joining us, David.
You're welcome.
First of all, something I noticed on Facebook, because we are friends on Facebook. You had a little... something that's going around is the tell some everyone seven things that they didn't know about you.
Yeah.
And I want to start with this because it was pretty interesting and I think it will give people a good introduction to you. So point one, you were once deported from Russia.
Yeah, well... I wasn't actually deported, I suppose. More, I was refused entry. It was just a minor visa issue, and they sent me back on the same plane that carried me out there. So I wasn't particularly happy about that.
And you were going for fossils?
Yes, I was. I was traveling with Russians.
Yep.
And I was the only non-Russian member of the organising committee of a scientific conference out there. And regardless, they still wouldn't let me in, and it was just, you know, a day early on the visa. But I did get back a week later.
Not a day later?
No, I had to convince the university that they should fund the second trip out there, and then I had to buy tickets and arrange where to meet people and so on and so forth. So it did take a little while.
Yeah, it sounds like a pain. Let's leave that one.
Okay.
Right. There's a Dr. David Penny Scholarship Prize for Excellence in Science at a school in India, awarded annually to the student who gets the highest mark in science.
Yes, I spent some time in India and ended up going to a rural school out there where the kids are very poor. And one individual suggested that I could help by setting up a scholarship out there, whereby I just gave them some money. And that went in the bank, and the interest that accrues on it is awarded annually to the highest achieving student in science. So it helps them, you know, it's not a lot, but it helps them, and they can put it on their CV and what have you.
Do you know any of the award recipients and the kind of things that they've been doing?
I did. I was informed the first few years that it was up and running, but I must say I've kind of lost touch now, unfortunately. Okay.
Right, point three, there's two species of extinct animals named after you.
Yes, one's a fossil insect from the Crato Formation, and the other is a fossil spider preserved in amber from Mexico.
Nice, and who named them after you?
The Crato was named by Federica Menon and colleagues, and the spider was named by a chap called García Villafuerte, if I remember correctly and pronounced correctly.
And what's it like having a species named after you?
Oh, I was delighted. It was fabulous, yeah. Very nice.
I guess you'll always remember that species.
I've actually got a photograph of the Crato specimen on my fridge. Unfortunately, the amber spider is not so photogenic.
Nah. Right, you once turned down a funded postdoc research position in the USA to go and live in West Africa with no plans.
Yes.
you just up and leave?
Yeah, you know, I expect there'll be many people in search of postdocs that would say, wow, how can you do that? In all honesty, despite the fact I don't believe it, I suspect there was a degree of black magic involved in that.
But why West Africa?
I'd gone out there to celebrate getting the postdoc in part. And I was out there for a couple of months, and I was just hanging around with a few guys from Sierra Leone and spent most of my time with them. And they didn't have anything. They had no money. They had no jobs. But they were happy. You know, they didn't have a care in the world, really. The likes that we have in the Western world, I mean, we're always striving for the next grant, for the next postdoc, for the next job, for the next paper, for high impact factors. And I just thought, this is kind of not really right. Mm. And I basically saw a different side to life and thought, you know, I fancy giving this a try. And so I decided to give up science and moved out there. And in actual fact, I found it very hard to give up science. So I continued collecting data and doing research in the forests out there. Because I suppose it's something that I just enjoy too much, really. But I got a lot from doing it, yeah.
Which I think would lead us on to point five. You have been bitten by all sorts of bugs and had most common parasites you care to name, but your favourite has to be the tumbu fly maggots inside of your head.
Yeah, that was rather interesting. It's a parasitic fly that lays its eggs on damp clothing. And if you put the clothing on damp, the eggs hatch and the larva, which is a little maggot, burrows under your skin. And it lives there until it's matured, feeding off, not off your live tissues. I'm not exactly sure what it feeds off, but it keeps its environment very clean. So it's best to just leave it, and when it grows and it's mature, it comes out by itself. A lot of the locals were telling me I should try and pull it out with a thorn or a pointy stick, but you risk infection by doing that because the maggots don't want to come out, and they've got little hooks along the bodies to keep them in place. So if you try and pull them out, actually there's one way that you are supposed to be able to get them out, and that's to stick a slab of meat over the wound. And right. Sometimes, apparently, they crawl into the meat, but I don't think that's really works, to be honest. Another idea was that you can put Vaseline over it, and that stops them being able to breathe. And then they come out that way. But I was quite happy. I wanted to see what...
You're quite happy?
Yeah, until I went out in the sunshine. It didn't like the sunshine because it used to squirm. And that was quite painful, but you know, only for a couple of weeks.
And then when it came out, did you miss it?
I tried to find it. I wouldn't say I missed it too much. I did a little bit, I suppose.
Did you name it?
No. I did have several others, though, so it wasn't a lonesome thing.
Right, you've written 10 books?
Yes. mainly on fossils and fossils in amber, but also on spiders and insects and of West Africa where I was, because there were no available field guides for the apart from for birds. So I spent most of my time in the forests photographing things, recording behaviours, and decided to put a few field guides together.
Okay, and last point, you were bitten in the eye by a snake when you were 15.
Yes. It was a pet, and it wasn't a very friendly one.
No, it didn't sound it.
No. It didn't cause any real damage, but it upset my mother quite a bit. And... yeah, I had to go to hospital and have stitches in the eyeball. And so what they basically did was they clamped my eye open so I could see everything. It was done under local anaesthetic.
Like in Clockwork Orange?
Well, I don't recall the part of the movie. I recall the movie, but not necessarily the part of the movie where that happened. But certainly I do remember seeing needles coming to my eye and scalpels as they were tidying it up. Yeah, I do. I recall that. Yeah.
Right, so hopefully we've got the entire audience squirming and having to listen to that. So we'll start off with paleontology then. So you are a spider researcher, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and how did you get into that?
Well, I did an undergraduate degree in zoology at Manchester, which I finished in 1994, and that was just after the first Jurassic Park film had been released. So fossils in amber were very much in the public's imagination. And I was kind of in the right place at the right time to embark on a PhD studying fossils preserved in amber. And because of other members of staff there, we chose to do spiders preserved in amber.
And that was Paul Selden?
That's correct, yeah, Paul Selden.
And he's a big chilicerate guy.
Yes.
So spiders, scorpions, all of that lot with big pointy fangs.
Yeah.
And then you are Siri Scientific Press.
That's right, yes.
Okay, what do you do?
Okay, so while I was in Africa, I wrote a book on Dominican amber spiders, which is what I researched for my PhD and what I'd done for probably 5 years, 6 or 7 years subsequently as a postdoctoral researcher. And so I wrote this book and tried to get it published. And despite getting excellent reviews, I couldn't find a publisher. Even academic publishers deemed it to be too specialist interest for it to be worthwhile for them. And that left me two options: vanity publishing or setting myself up as a publisher. So I opted for the latter and named it Siri Scientific Press after my daughter, who was 6 months old at the time.
So in a normal situation, you would go to, you'd write a book, take it to a publisher, the same way that you'd write an academic paper and take it to a publisher, and you need someone to basically print it for you.
Probably not, no. I kind of did it the wrong way. I wrote the book and then approach the publisher.
Okay.
What normally happens is you put together a proposal for a book, then approach the publisher, and they say, yes, this is good, or no, we're not interested. And a lot of the time, you can't even approach the publisher directly. You need to do it through an agent. So you need to have a literary agent who acts as a go-between, because most publishers will not receive or will not accept unsolicited manuscripts, particularly from first-time authors. But I'd already written a book.
All right, so do you do it in the same way now? Do you accept just books from anyone, or do you use the agents? And
no, I don't use agents. I'm happy to hear from anybody that has a project that falls within our remit or close to our remit. And I'm happy to hear from them at any stage of the project, wherever they are, whether it be just the initial idea or whether they're further down the line.
So what kind of books have you had through Siri be published?
Paleontology books. We specialise in books on fossils, paleontology, and entomology, so insects. But we're expanding to cover broader natural history in general. So we're happy to hear, you know, from anybody really that has something that's kind of within the natural history realm.
Is it hard to kind of muscle in on the territory of these big academic publishers then? Do they look at you and think, like, need to get rid of this annoying little fly burrowing into our scalps?
Well, the way I see it, I personally don't think that I've exactly gone up against them. I'm a small fish in a big pond, and I probably swim around unnoticed most of the time, if not all of the time. I do my own thing, which more often than not, but not always, would not be of much interest to the larger publishers. Indeed, on several occasions, my authors have come to me following rejection by the larger publishers. I'm more concerned in producing quality products and interesting books rather than the amount of money they're likely to return.
Okay, so it's kind of the same situation as the book that you tried to get published first. It was too niche, it was too specialist.
Yeah. That book, it's recovered its costs, but slowly. There are some of my titles that don't always recover their costs, and it doesn't concern me so much so long as I have others that do.
Okay, so the book that we're discussing today is Fossil Insects, which you not only published through Siri, but you also wrote along with Dr. James Jepson.
That's right, yeah.
So could you tell us about James?
James did a PhD in Manchester, and he was working on fossil insects in rock. So this kind of complemented my research on the amber fossil fauna. And James is now currently in Germany at the Museum for Naturkunde in Berlin, doing a postdoc out there. So the book was released in 2014 with the aim of filling the void between the two massive disciplines of paleontology and entomology. So big is this void that even in universities, these subject areas usually fall under different faculties. Paleontology courses in earth science departments, with rarely any elements of entomology included. Likewise, entomology courses in life science departments, usually with barely any content on the fossil record. So this book, which is lavishly, is well illustrated, is the first book to merge these two disciplines at a level accessible to a broad audience, including undergraduate students, but also the general public as well.
So one of the first things we always like to do with a new group is outline what they are, what defines them. So what is an insect?
An insect, it's an animal with three pairs of jointed legs. So they've got six legs. They have three parts to the body. So they've got a head with a single pair of antennae, a thorax with the six pair, the six jointed legs, usually with a pair or two pairs of wings in the adults, and then they have an abdomen as well. So six legs, three parts to the body, and usually wings.
And how important a group are they? I think they are the most numerous group in the world.
Yeah, there's two parts to that question. How important are they and how numerous are they? They are incredibly important. They are integral components of all terrestrial and freshwater ecosystems. They're important as pollinators, as parasites, as predators, as recyclers of dead matter, as vectors of disease, and as a food source for other animals, including humans. In terms of how many species there are, over a million species of living insect today have been described. With estimates of possibly anything from 2 million to 100 million as the total expected diversity.
Wow.
So it's very difficult to put an accurate number on that. Lots of different estimates going around. So obviously there are many insect species waiting to be described, whereas for mammals and birds, for example, it's quite uncommon, relatively speaking, to find a new species. Mm-hmm. What we can be sure of, though, is that today's diversity represents a snapshot of total insect diversity since their origins more than 400 million years ago. It's literally the blink of an eye. So what we've got today is nothing compared to what has gone before.
But in all of that diversity, is it just things like beetles and strange flies? I mean, there's so many beetles. Is it all just like over diversity of around a single body plan sort of thing?
Not really. And it's interesting that you should mention beetles, because when people talk about diverse insects, they always refer to beetles as the most diverse insect order. And that's often stated in many textbooks, entomology textbooks as well. And while that may be true in terms of numbers of described species, the reality is that beetles may not be the most diverse order, and possibly the ants, bees and wasps, the Hymenoptera, may be more diverse because you've got so many different small parasitoid wasps that await description. So, yes, beetles are extremely diverse. Yes, flies are extremely diverse. But there's three other orders: the true bugs, the Hemiptera, as I've already mentioned, the ants, bees and wasps, which form the order Hymenoptera, and the butterflies and moths, which form the Lepidoptera. They're the five most diverse orders. But then there are another 20-odd extant insect orders that also have a, you know, maybe a smaller degree of diversity, but they're no less important.
I think I even remember a new species of parasitoid wasp being described in South Korea in just the past week.
Just very recently, yeah, yeah. I did see something about that, but I didn't look at it in any great detail.
Okay, and do their ecological diversity mirror this sheer taxonomic diversity?
Yeah, as I mentioned, they're integral elements of all terrestrial and freshwater ecosystems. And some of the niches that they occupy are incredibly specialised. I mean, this is evident in terms of the monophagous insects, which are those that feed on one particular type of food plant, for example. And it's also true of often in parasitic insects, like this little beast that burrowed into my head. And you even get some that are parasites of parasites that are already inside another insect. So we call that hyperparasitism.
Right. So considering the fossil record now, when and where do we see the first evidence for insects?
The first primitive insect-type organisms are from the Devonian, from the Rhynie Chert of Scotland, where we find springtails and some other examples of mouthparts. But it's not until the Carboniferous that we start to see a diverse fossil insect fauna with flying forms and what have you.
I think perhaps the one of the most famous ones in the Carboniferous, or at least the one that comes into my mind, is Meganeura.
Yeah, the griffon flies, the giant dragonfly-like things, are what most people think of when you talk about fossil insects, because they are probably the only insect to be depicted in environmental reconstructions.
Yeah, I guess because they're easier to draw. I mean,
not necessarily. It's because people don't really know, or I suppose the general consensus is that people are not really aware of the diversity of fossil insects. And that's kind of, as I explained earlier, about the degree courses, there's very little overlap. So it's only those that are in the know that understand that, wow, actually, there's a really diverse insect fauna here, and it consists of this, 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 and this. But most people just opt for the easy option and go, well, let's just stick a dragonfly in there and, you know, we covered entomologically.
I guess it might be a question of scale as well, because most paleo art reconstructions are of a larger scale. You got all your big trees, so it'd be pretty hard to draw some tiny insects on it.
Not necessarily, no, because, you know, so many, many paleo artists are extremely clever and understand perspective, and can do remarkable things, as is demonstrated by the artistic reconstructions in the book, which readily show diverse entomofaunas in the various geological settings, such as the Crato Formation of Brazil, the Baltic Amber Forests, the Jurassic of China and so on.
So did you have to get a specialist paleo artist for the book?
Yes, I worked closely with a chap called Richard Bisley, who is an excellent paleo artist from Lyme Regis, though he hadn't done a great deal on fossil insects before. But he was willing to learn, and I was willing to learn, and we were able to work very closely together in order to get accurate depictions of the paleo environment and the insects that lived therein.
So was it a case of having to instruct us to what the important anatomical characters of the insects are to make sure you get those right?
Yes, I provided the, should we say, the taxonomic input. I suggested what insects we needed and what the important features of those insects were. I provided him with illustrations of as complete fossils as possible, modern counterparts, and he then went away and made models. And he could get the light from the models and cast shadows and so on and so forth so that he got everything right. And he'd send me drafts and I'd say, wow, well, maybe these wings are a bit small. And then he'd change the hind wings to make them the right size. And you couldn't notice any change, despite the fact that he's doing this in a traditional manner, not on a computer, where it's easy enough to make changes. But he's kind of a genius, really, when it comes to doing paleo artwork.
Sorry about that. I just distracted. Took us off topic.
Well, no, I've got a lot of respect for Richard. In fact, so much so that I named a new species of harvestman after him earlier this year, or at the end of last year. The very end of last year.
So the harvestman, little spidery things with long legs.
Tiny arachnid, not quite a spider, but closely related to a spider. And that was described with Jason Dunlop in Berlin and Plamen Mitov in Bulgaria.
Do you know if he's got a picture of it on his fridge?
I don't know, not yet. But he will be working on another artistic reconstruction of the Baltic Amber Forest in which this will have pride of place.
Of course. So we ascertained that the first fossil insects we get are Rhynie chert, which is a terrestrial ecosystem. It's a siliceous environment, sort of like Yellowstone National Park, where you get all of these terrestrial environments covered in silica. It's just like being entombed in glass, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the first evidence of insects we have is that they're already terrestrial. But if life evolved in the oceans, are there any aquatic insects?
Not from Rhynie that we're aware of, but the entomofauna of Rhynie is highly, highly, highly limited. So when we get to the Carboniferous, we do have evidence of aquatic forms because we've got the giant griffin flies, which no doubt had aquatic larvae, as do the dragonflies of today. But we've also got non-aquatic forms there as well. So we've got the primitive roachoids, which look like cockroaches of today, but differ in that they had ovipositors for laying eggs, which they don't have today. So the classification of those things is a bit problematic at the moment.
But do we get any, like, marine insects or purely ones that will spend all of their time underwater, never come out, never use the wings?
Well, not that I'm aware of at that time. And in terms of marine, it tends to infer a saline environment anyway. And we don't have marine insects today that I'm aware of. It's just fresh water.
So where did they come from? They must have emerged out of the water at some point.
You know,
they just appear and they're just terrestrial?
The origins of insects have not been resolved. So the closest relative of, where do they branch off the evolutionary tree? Is it from crustacea or is it from myriapoda? We don't fully know. I think molecular evidence is now pointing. Previously, it was thought they were from myriapods.
Which are things like centipedes and millipedes.
And the like, yeah. But I think molecular evidence these days is pointing more to crustacean origins.
So crabs and lobsters and stuff like that. Yep. Okay, so in your book, you give an introduction to the insects, but you also highlight some of the localities and some of the Lagerstätte, the sites of special preservation, which insects are found in all around the world. So where are some of the standout places? Is there anywhere that's particularly good for finding insects?
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. In the second part, we're going to get really stuck into fossil insects, and we're going to be told some really surprising facts. Until then, don't forget to enter our competition on our Facebook page, and please subscribe to our show on iTunes or by using our RSS feed. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.